This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never love a son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is Race and Fraud, The Races of Mankind, Part 1. It's really a continuation of the last installment, so I'd recommend you listen to that if you haven't already. I'm going to pick up right where I left off the last time. I was talking about variations on this pamphlet, The Races of Mankind. Before I'd even talked about the pamphlet itself, which started it all, I had discovered that in my research on it that there were other forms that it took. And that, I think, is evidence that it was really close to the heart of these professors. This was not some idea that came out of the military, because I don't think that they would have continued to work on it and continued to create these variations if it had been a military idea. They would have abandoned it, and I think it was more personal to them to continue the work. I ended here talking about this UPA animation studio that made an animated version of it. But in 1948, Weltfish, one of the co-authors of this Races of Mankind pamphlet I talked about the last time, and Violet Edwards, under the supervision of Ruth Benedict, adapted this Brotherhood of Man animation and made it into this other book that they wrote titled In Henry's Backyard, The Races of Mankind. And they illustrated it with images from the cartoon. It's a little bit complicated there, but they originally made this pamphlet for the military in 43. 45, these animation guys, a bunch of disgruntled former Disney, former communist, probably Jewish animation people, adopted the project, made it their own, and then Weltfish, under Benedict's supervision, took it back and made something more out of it. And I found this out by reading there was an editorial introduction to this children's story, they produced from it. And it goes on, it notes how the New York Times Book Review gave it an unfavorable review, disagreed with the book's central claim of race equality. It also discredits the authors on the grounds that both work in anthropology, which, quote, is not a true science at all, but a kind of specialized reportage. That's what they were saying in 1948 about anthropology. Today, of course, it's considered a science. Everything it says is absolutely true. But at the time, I think they had a closer view of what was going on with it. And also the race in the 40s, it was controversial to question it in the way that this pamphlet and the subsequent efforts on this Races of Mankind did. It wasn't a full-blown denial that race exists, but it did call into question whether it was significant or not. As I've said before, that was Boas's thin edge of the wedge that he introduced. He didn't deny that race existed flat out. He and his students, people who came after him, just chipped away at it until it became what it is today, which is race doesn't exist at all. This editorial introduction goes on. From the 1930s through the 1960s, the FBI believed opponents of racism were also communists. So that's how this communist business fits in, and there's more on it. As David H. Price points out, what were scientists like Gene Weltfish to do? When America's main political parties condoned Jim Crow racism and the Communist Party's position on racial equality was in total alignment with the scientific findings of biological and anthropological research. Again, this confirms that at the time in the 1940s and before, that both of America's main political parties condoned Jim Crow racism. This is the retrospective view of it now. How could they have been so crazy? But that was the norm at the time. And it was the Communist Party's position that it was an ideological position that the races are equal. There are no significant differences between them. And there's a bit of a lie here that there were scientific findings anthropological and biological research that agreed with this idea of race equality, that there were no significant racial differences. The truth is exactly the opposite. The biology, race science up until that time, race in science, it was a scientific endeavor. As I covered in my Race and Genetics series, white European men were uncovering lots of racial differences and coming to a clearer understanding of what race was and how significant it was. Madison Grant, his effort was in trying to understand how it helped explain race, how it explained history and European history in particular. And that's how we get into this whole anthropology subject, and which is really the rerouting of what was a scientific, a purely objective understanding into something that was more narrative, where you could start making up stories to explain things rather than actually doing experiments to provide empirical evidence for things. But this editorial introduction goes and tells you the exact opposite. It goes on, the activism of Benedict and Weldfish was rooted in the empirical methods of scientific inquiry, not in the Procrustean confines of ideological doctrine. The truth is exactly the opposite. They wrapped themselves in science. They claimed that what they were doing was sharing scientific results, but it was all a bluff, really. That's part of the fraud. What they were doing was ideologically driven. In Benedict's case, it was communist sympathies. It was a feeling maybe of sympathy for these Indian peoples, these other non-white peoples that she had studied. I think with her and with Weldfish, and Weldfish had her own sympathies with her own Jewish tribe, but with both of them, you could say that there's probably an element of going native to them. That they, and what I mean by that, of course, is like the theme of recent movies like Avatar or Dances with Wolves. It's a common theme in Jewish Hollywood films is to encourage people to go native, you know, feel more sympathy for alien peoples than you feel for your own peoples. And that's this anthropological culture of critique, attack on Western culture and people. At the same time, they were telling everyone, hey, it's not cool to criticize other cultures and peoples, and we shouldn't even talk about other peoples. It's really just the cultures that's important. It's not the people. It's not genetic. It's not biological. It's not racial. They were doing exactly the opposite to Western peoples, criticizing Western culture as if they hated it, as if they wanted to destroy it. And it's had an effect very close to destruction. It certainly has changed Europe and America and all of the previously Western societies into something completely different now. Certainly completely different than what even as recently as the 1940s, what both parties were for, which was a preference for white people. This book, Henry's Backyard, I can't read it. In the thing it's embedded in, the editor's introduction is intact, but then the book itself is missing pieces, large pieces, and you can only see little snippets of the text. But it seems to be a children's book. It's aimed at children, and it's a recasting. It's not a reprint in direct form of the pamphlet. It's a rewriting, really, in a parable story form. The pretense that it's objective scientific facts or arguments is gone, and now it's put into this story. And a, you know, parable, I use the word parable, a short allegorical story. It's designed to illustrate or teach some truth or religious principle or moral lesson. And that's exactly what it is. It's a religious principle or a moral lesson. It isn't the truth. It's the opposite. And there was one snippet that I got a glimpse of here, and this will give you, I think, an idea of what the purpose was behind the original pamphlet and behind this children's book. This is now directly from the book. Sensible people learn to live in peace and friendship. They know that the differences in the way people behave are not inherited from their ancestors. They come from something called cultural experience or environment. Sensible people stop kicking each other around and apply their boots to the seats of the ugly green devils of prejudice, stupidity, and hate. And this is the essence of their effort. This is what they're trying to do. They're trying to say sensible, smart people don't beat each other up. Instead, they beat up the racists, the stupid, crazy, evil, green devils. I use the phrase pathologization and demonization a lot when I talk about this stuff to describe what they're doing to white people, what they're doing when they call us racists. They're pathologizing, meaning, you know, they make it sound or say flat out that they think it's a mental disease. It's some sort of mental disorder that people have, these racists, to believe that race is real and to believe these other things about race. And they demonize. And in this case, you see it in Green Devils. I mean, they literally are making racists out to be demons, which implies we're immoral, we're inhuman, and so it's okay to hate us. And in fact, that's what they're attempting to do. It's not that they're against divisiveness or against us and them, like they often paint themselves. And, you know, it's those horrible racists, so the people who believe in us and them. They believe in us and them. It's us anti-racists against them racists. They just want to change the division. Instead of being divided by race, which is perfectly natural, they want to divide it into anti-racists versus racists. And they use lies and a fraud to do that. Propaganda, lots of tools. This source also revealed to me that this third person who was involved in the project, the original pamphlet, the one who did the illustrations, his name was Ad Reinhardt. And I looked up his Wikipedia page, which doesn't mention his participation in the pamphlet, and neither do the two pages on Benedict and the other one. But his Wikipedia page says that his name is Adolf Frederick Reinhardt, AD for short, born in 1913. He died in 1967. He was an abstract painter, active in New York, another New Yorker, something I guess all three of them had in common. He started working in the 1930s and continued through the 1960s. He was a member of the Abstract Expressionism movement. And he's best known, according to the wiki page on him, for his so-called black paintings of the 1960s, the ultimate in abstract expressionism, I guess. And they appear at first glance to be simply canvases painted black, but are actually composed of black and nearly black shades. How profound. That's typical of Jewish art. And in fact, the wiki page on him doesn't mention that he's Jewish. I suspected he was, and so I searched for his name and the word Jewish, and found, sure enough, lots of references where his works have been displayed by Jewish museums, and a piece in the New York Times that mentions pretty directly that he's a Jew. Here we have, another person who's pretty obviously motivated by his Jewish identity to participate in a project that basically masks the Jews, and that's what anti-racism is to Jews. They see race or an understanding of group identity in terms of race as unmasking them, and so they want to destroy it for that reason. So before getting into The Races of Mankind, the pamphlet itself, and discussing that, I want to just mention here that the feeling that I get from reading it, and from reading many of these stories of anthropologists, the phrase, a just-so story, came to my mind, and I had never looked it up before, but I did look it up this time. It's described in Wikipedia as, in science and philosophy, a just-so story, also called an ad hoc fallacy, is an unverifiable and unfalsifiable narrative explanation for a cultural practice, a biological trait, or behavior of humans or other animals. The pejorative nature of the expression is an implicit criticism that reminds the hearer of the essentially fictional an unprovable nature of such an explanation. Such tales are common in folklore and mythology. And I recall that Ruth Benedict was described as a folklorist. That was her specialty. And I think that this just-so story is a good way of summarizing exactly what anthropologists do. They create these just-so stories about culture and what its meaning is. It's a narrative. A narrative is from a point of view, and a point of view sympathetic to non-European, non-white cultures, and antipathetic to Western cultures and white people. So, The Races of Mankind, and I'm going to link here the PDF that I found that's on the Internet Archive, a great resource. No nonsense there, no narrative explaining what this pamphlet is. It's just the pamphlet itself, described as Public Affairs Pamphlet number 85. The two authors are credited, Ruth Benedict, Gene Weltfish, as being from the Department of Anthropology, Columbia University. The copyright is from 1946. So this must be the pamphlet that was published, the 10 million or the million copies that were published in the 10 years after the original release in 1943. It's 31 pages long. The first section is titled, The World is Shrinking. And I'm not going to read this whole pamphlet, but I am going to read sections of it and then comment on these sections. And the purpose in doing this, I think, is to confront these just-so stories that they tell, to give you a flavor for what I'm talking about. It's not typical of academic anthropology, because this was written to be in simple terms for the ordinary person who didn't have an academic background, probably didn't have a college education. But that doesn't mean it has to lie. It's not an excuse to lie or to not tell the truth about things. And I'm going to illustrate in some of these sections that I read how exactly it works and how they are distorting the truth, how they do it. The war for the first time brought home to Americans the fact that the whole world has been made one neighborhood. All races of man were shoulder to shoulder. Our armed forces were in North Africa with its Negro, Berber, and Near East peoples. They were in India. They were in China. They were in the Solomons with its dark-skinned, strong-haired Melanesians. People of all races of the earth became our neighbors. Americans know better than most how much hard feelings there can be when people of different races and nationalities have to live together and be part of one community. They know that there is often conflict when what we all wanted more than anything else was to win this war. Most Americans were confident that whatever our origins, we would be able to pull together to a final victory. And let me stop right there before I go on. The implication is that different races are neighbors and should work together here, or must work together, in fact, that there's an imperative that we work together. It's also implied here that this was the first time that this happened. I mean, they say literally the first time the whole world had been made one neighborhood. Well, this actually was an ongoing process that began with the Age of Discovery that I've mentioned before, hundreds of years earlier, when the European man, not the Melanesian, not the Indians, but the white man, went out into the world, went adventuring, discovering these other peoples of the world. And this understanding of race came from that, at least the coarse version of race. And it was from seeing that stark contrast with other peoples that made, I think, Europeans appreciate even the racial differences amongst Europeans, the finer grain differences that I've talked about before. In fact, in America, 200 years before this was written, the English and the French were standing shoulder to shoulder with the red man and against each other. And they did it without any delusion that the red man was their neighbor or that they were, any of them were equal to each other. The English and the French didn't consider themselves equals, and neither of them considered the red man their equal. But they were able to work together against each other. So much for that idea that we're all neighbors and that implies that somehow race doesn't exist or doesn't matter. This is implying that we have to work together, that we have to live together, that there's some imperative. It's not spelled out. What is forcing us to live together? One thing, just trying to be fair, I thought to myself, well, maybe it's the fact that the world is getting smaller because it's becoming more crowded. Well, it doesn't make things any easier or give us any more space to say that, well, half of your people come over here and live in our homeland and half of our people will go over to your homeland. That doesn't change the amount of space that's available. And they're stating pretty openly here that they're well aware that there are hard feelings caused by diversity. Diversity is divisive. It's not our greatest strength, this reality-inverting slogan that we hear today. They didn't voice that back then. That wasn't the approach. They were just trying to say that race wasn't so significant. Racial differences weren't so significant. They didn't deny that race exists. It existed. There are hard feelings between races, and that's not to say that they can't be overcome. As I pointed out the last time, memes are important and they can override genes. The ideology can overcome biology, especially when you use propaganda, especially when you're willing to use lies and deceit and tell people that they have to fight together to beat this evil, evil enemy. This pamphlet was part of that propaganda effort. The next section that they move on to is science and the race front. And this is where they're going to try and tell us that science argues against race. In any great issue that concerned the war, we turned to science. When we needed new fuel, substitutes for rubber, lighter metals, or new plastics, we asked scientists to tell us what was possible and what was impossible. The chemists told us to make the plastics we needed, and the physicists told us how to detect and locate an approaching airplane. And the engineers told us how to build a better fighting plane. When we were faced with war shortages, they told us what essential materials we had been throwing out on the dump heap. We needed the scientists just as much on the race front. Scientists have studied race. Historians have studied the history of all nations and peoples. Sociologists have studied the way in which peoples band together. Biologists have studied how man's physical traits are passed down from one generation to the next. Anthropologists have studied man's bodily measurements and his cultural achievements. Psychologists have studied intelligence among different races. All that the scientists had learned became important to us at this crucial moment in history. They told us, this is so, this is not so, this occurs under certain conditions, or this occurs under opposite conditions. This booklet cannot tell you all that science has learned about the races of mankind, but it states facts that have been learned and verified. We need them. Now, this is part of the trick here. They're using the good reputation of science to produce tangible results. And they're saying, we're scientists. You should believe us because scientists do good things and scientists say things that you can believe in. And we're scientists. And that's really the whole trick behind this propaganda here. This is a misrepresentation of themselves. They're anti-racists. They're trying to argue against the significance of race, although here they're making the gestures that they actually are acknowledging it. It's part of their lying technique, throwing out lots and lots of facts, acting like they're scientists, just by making scientific-sounding statements here. The next section here is titled One Human Race. Now, this is quite the opposite of science. It says, the Bible story of Adam and Eve, father and mother of the whole human race, told centuries ago the same truth that science has shown today, that all peoples of the earth are single family and have a common origin. Now, I talked about this a little bit when I first talked about Darwin and Darwinism and how controversial Darwin was because he challenged the Christian orthodoxy of creationism, of the idea that God created everything as it is right now, as we see it, different races, everything, and it's just always been that way. And Darwin's revolutionary idea was that we're all related in this tree of life. That was the imagery that was used at the time. And the evidence is in the DNA. It's in the biochemistry that scientists have uncovered, and that is how heredity is passed from generation to generation, and that it does show that we share quite a bit of mechanics with all these other forms of life. And these people are just using whatever to appeal to the masses, and that they knew that what they were writing to here were soldiers, white soldiers in the U.S. military. Probably most of them were Bible-believing Christians. You know, a lot of these arguments that they use against race or to question the existence of race can be used just as easily against the concept of family. And I just want to leave you with that thought as we go on here reading some of these things, that when they talk about races being able to work together across racial boundaries, that the same thing is true of individuals that are members of families, that they go outside of their family and they work with other people that aren't part of their families. That doesn't mean that family doesn't exist. It doesn't mean that family isn't important. It doesn't even mean that family isn't more important to those people just because they go out into the world and cooperate with other people that aren't members of their direct family. And also another thing about family that's analogous to race is the multi-scale of it. The like race, family has a small, fine-grained meaning of the nuclear family, the mother and father and children. But it also, there's an extended family of grandparents and grandchildren and cousins, and even beyond that, an even larger extended family of kin. And then to the larger population of a whole nation or even your race, where you're more related to any European than you are to, say, an African. When they mention here that we're all a single family and have a common origin, that doesn't mean that the other understanding of families, the extended and the nuclear and so forth, the narrow and the broader idea of family, that exists or is invalid or is even confusing. Everybody understands those different scales of family, and race is the same. It has different scales to it. That doesn't invalidate the idea. No difference among human races has affected limbs and teeth and relative strength, so that one race is biologically outfitted like a lion and another biologically outfitted like a lamb. All races of men can either plow or fight, and all the racial differences among them are in non-essentials, such as texture of head hair, amount of body hair, shape of the nose or head, or color of the eyes and the skin. It's interesting that they admit that there are all those different physical, visible differences. They say right at the beginning that they're non-essentials, which I would disagree with. But today, of course, this has all just been reduced to color of skin. They don't even go into all the other differences because, you know, when you really list out what all the physical, visible differences are, it becomes quite a convincing argument that there are races and that there are racial differences and that they are significant. When you go into the unseen ones that science has uncovered, and especially medical science, the case becomes even more convincing. And part of the confusion here that they're trying to leverage is that there is no black and white to it, that literally black people can do this and white people can't do that, or vice versa. There is just a mixture of abilities. It's a mixture of tendencies, really, in various aspects, physical, mental aspects. But this is one of the sleights of hand that they use, that they're saying that just because every race exhibits various tendencies, they're glossing over the whole fact that the mixture, that the proportion of various tendencies is different in the different races. And we'll see more of that as we go on. After the discovery of America by Columbus, Europeans began traveling to every quarter of the globe, and all the new peoples they met were complete strangers to them. For one thing, the Europeans couldn't understand their languages. They looked and acted strange. Europeans thought they were different creatures and named a lot of different races. Gradually, the Europeans described each one as having a skin color, a kind of hair, a kind of lips, height, and head shape that was peculiar to that race. Nowadays, we know that this was a false impression. We know no such thing. They're just asserting that out of the blue. This is trying to make Europeans look like the idiots. I mean, here it was, Europeans were the ones getting on boats and sailing around to the other side of the globe. Obviously, it was the Europeans who were more capable in this case. But here in this narrative, it's trying to make Europeans look like foolish people. Or let us take the brain itself. Because the brain is the thinking organ, some scientists have tried to find differences in the size and structure of the brain among different groups of people. In spite of these efforts, using the finest microscopes, the best scientists cannot tell from examining a brain to what group of people its owner belonged. The average size of the brain is different in different groups, but it has been proved over and over again that the size of the brain has nothing to do with intelligence. A couple of tricks that they're using here is, yes, the brain is important, and scientists have long realized that the brain was important because of this unique nature of man to use communication and thinking and strategy, this whole level of competition in which we compete with each other and we organize ourselves into groups that has analogies in other forms of life, but I don't think there's anything really directly like us. Even amongst the apes, they don't seem to have the intelligence that we have, and they're 99% or 98% similar to us genetically, as the saying always goes amongst these anti-racists, but yet they're missing in that 2% that's different, the ability to think and talk at a human level. I, for one, don't want to share my society with apes, even though they're only 2% different in DNA. And I think it's likewise for race. I mean, and that's what it comes down to, is that the anti-racists are arguing in favor of every society, or at least white societies, Western societies, being open to being neighbors with everyone and having those neighbors living in your house with you, in which case they're not neighbors anymore. You're forced to have them live in your house with you. A point about this brain business is, I wonder if even using the finest microscopes today, that the best scientists could tell the difference between a chimpanzee brain and a human brain. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if they couldn't tell the difference between those brains. And that doesn't mean that chimpanzees are the same as human beings. This is one of those bogus arguments these anthropologists, this is typical in their stuff and in how they think, how they argue. And you know, these people, speaking of brains, they're too smart to not see the intellectual dishonesty in the arguments that they're making. It's ideologically driven. They know that the goal is to discredit racism. They want to deny that there is any significance to race. And so they're coming up with every argument that they can think of, and they're doing it even in dishonest ways to convince people that there is no significant difference between races.